You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 255 is Michael Timmins, best known as the guitarist and songwriter for Cowboy Junkies. You're right now listening to Misguided Angel from their second album, The Trinity Session, 1988, co-written with his sister Margot Timmins. As Michael will tell us, he had started out in the late 70s, early 80s, playing with Alan Anton, the eventual bass player for Cowboy Junkies, in projects called Hunger Project and Germinal. Cowboy Junkies formed in the mid-80s with Alan and Margot and two other Timmins siblings, one of whom Peter Timmins stuck around as their drummer. They've released about 21 albums, plus several live releases, couple EPs. Michael has recorded an instrumental solo album, did a soundtrack, has participated in a couple collaborations, including one called Lee Harvey Osmond that has released four albums. We're going to stick to Cowboy Junkies in our discussion today. We'll look at Throw a Match from their last released studio album, Such Ferocious Beauty, 2023. Then the 2025 acoustic release on More Acoustic Junk of He Will Call You Baby, which is a song originally released on their 2004 One Soul Now album. Then we'll look all the way back to The Caution Horses, the album from 1990, for the song Rock and Bird. We'll conclude by listening to Unanswered Letter from The Wilderness, The Nomad Series Volume 4, 2012. For more information, please see cowboyjunkies.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of Misguided Angel from the Trinity Session, 1988, the first album of More Originals, right? And actually, it was just this morning I heard your pre that you were doing stuff all the way back to like 1982 and was hearing some more jam-oriented stuff. Yeah. Do you want to say a little?
Yeah. Even earlier than that, Alan and I, this is a bass player in Cowboy Junkies, got together. I mean, we've been friends for our entire lives, but we started playing in bands together in 1979, a band called Hunger Project. And that was sort of like a Susie and the Banshees type post-punk type band. And that went for a few years. We did a few recordings on that. I don't know if they exist anywhere. Except
on YouTube is the single anyway.
Okay. And then that band broke up. We went on to play for a band called Germinal, which was a sort of an improvisation freeform band and no vocals. And then out of that, Cowboy Junkies developed. So, yeah, it's been going for a while. Junkies has been going for 41 years, but Alan and I have been going for getting close to 50 years.
Yeah, so that was all very clarifying. I mean, I had just, you know, known the popular stuff in the late 80s, early 90s when it came out. And just, okay, I'll take the name of the band, at least the cowboy part. It's an atmospheric, kind of soft country rock band. But no, you got this. It's really, I feel like Velvet Underground might be the key to unlocking this.
Yeah, that to me is the touchstone for us, I think. Before we brought in the country elements, you know, before Trinity Session, there was an album called White Sufferers Now, which borrows very heavily on blues music. And really, our aesthetic has always been Velvet Underground. You know, there are some soft songs on there, like the Velvet Underground. There's also a recognition and appreciation for noise, even if it's quiet noise, and just sort of a bit of psychedelic as well, especially live. I think if you see us live, you get a better sense of the range of the band's oeuvre, if you want to use the word.
Well, it was nice for me. You know, normally I only have a couple weeks to prep for these things, but we were supposed to do this in December. So I tried to listen through all the albums for that. Got through most of it, but it kind of all washed together. Then was able to see you live in Milwaukee between then and now. And then just over the past week, you listened again through all the albums. And like, okay, this actually makes sense now. Do you want to say a little about where you're at with the, I guess we were hoping maybe the new one would be out. You played a couple songs for the new one on the tour.
Yeah.
But the last full album, Such Ferocious Beauty, 2023, we're going to play Throw a Match. Do you want to say a little bit about where you're at, you know, 20 some albums later? From the initial thing.
The thing that connects all the records together is that our recordings and certainly our live shows are very band orientated, you know. Mm-hmm. People tend to focus on Margot, but really the whole thing comes together, just the four of us and live with the fifth member, Jeff Bird. And Throw a Match is a good example of that. It's a very kinetic and loose performance, but with lots of energy. And that's sort of what we like to go for. Even if it's a slow, calm song, we still want there to be sort of an underlying energy to things. And I think Throw a Match is a good example of that.
Okay. cares about. Just another story. Wind is like a mountain, absorbed as a sea. Steadfast like a forest, thinking again, reasoning. That's a good thing, but my love comes apart whenever you're missing. And I move back towards you one beat at a time. Heartbreak again, your hand in mine. Wind is like a mountain, absorbed as a sea. Steadfast like.
All right, so nice little funky groove. Yeah, I think I picked this out in December, so I'm not sure why this one in particular off this album. Probably because it had a little layering, that even though it sounds like it's a live recording, well, you've got piano and the triangle and you've got the thing, you know, at least it has some definite movement.
Yeah.
It seems like you're not afraid. For instance, we're going to talk about He Will Call You Baby, and we're actually going to talk about the new version of that from the acoustic album that you were promoting as of December. But the original version of that is kind of like, yeah, this is the part, and it's going to be slow and it's going to be long, but we don't need bells and whistles. But this song, I feel like, besides, you know, having a very fundamental core, has some bells and whistles, so that attracted me.
When we go into a studio, as I say, we want to capture the band, right? That's our main goal. Often that means setting up as a band and playing through songs and trying to get a bed track. And then if we want to add stuff to that, build on it. Any sort of added stuff is usually overdubs after the fact. These days, unlike Trinity Session, which was, you know, everything was done as a unit, we've become more traditional as we moved along. It's a lot easier to add stuff after the fact. Throw a Match is kind of interesting in that it feels very, very live off the floor as far as the band is concerned. But really, it's just the only real live part of that is my acoustic guitar and Margot's vocal. That was the actual demo that we did for the song. Margot and I worked a long time for the songs on Such Ferocious Beauty. We did a lot of demoing by the two of us. I'd write the songs, and then she would come and sing them, and she'd go away and come back and re-sing them and try and capture something, you know, try and capture the essence of the lyric and what I was trying to put across musically. And with this one day, we just captured this really, I thought, this really great version of the song. It's the two of us, and And ultimately, I was thinking that that would be the version we'd go with on the record. We just take the demo and use it because it just had this great energy to it. And Marty's performance was so great. So I sort of went with that. And then I played it to Alan. And he said, well, let me try something. And he put on that really funky Paul McCartney-ish bass line. And I said, okay, that's great. And then Pete heard that and said, well, let me try something. And he put on his very, very odd drum. So that everything began to build from there. So really, and then we added, you know, that little bit of piano and a triangle. And from what was supposed to be an acoustic guitar and vocal turned into this very layered production. But I don't think we lost the energy of that performance of the vocal and guitar performance. That was the key thing. And really, Such Ferocious Beauty was sort of like that. There's a lot of layering on that record, a denseness to it, I guess. You don't necessarily hear everything, but you certainly sense stuff. And the idea being, you know, not losing the band, but layering elements. So we do that occasionally. It depends on the record, depends on the songs, depends sort of what we've just done in the past, if we want to push things in a different direction. So it all depends on the individual song and also the album it's going on to.
I mean, Margo's voice still sounds very good. So clearly you're using a good mic for your demo. It's not a phone demo.
I learned over the years that whenever you're doing demos, you make sure you're recording them correctly, because occasionally you luck out and you get something like this where you capture the performance, and you want to make sure that the performance is captured audio wise. You want it to be captured properly. So that's something that I always do. I mic things up properly.
At the same time, though, it, you know, from the beginning where you hear a little of your voice, it sounds like there's a charming tape hiss. That is, unless that's just amp noise from someone.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be amp noise. It could be tons of stuff. I love that stuff. Like anything, I'm a big fan of random noises, certainly at the beginning and on the outro of songs. And I think I learned that by growing up in the, you know, listening to records in the late 60s and early 70s. That was the big thing, right? Like there's, if you listen to tons of Neil Young records are like that. You hear the studio, you know, you hear people talking. You don't necessarily hear what they're saying. You know, counts into songs or tape decks being shut off or whatever. I just love that stuff. It brings a certain amount of humanity to it. And I think for the listener, it sort of clues the listener into, you know, these are people these are people playing these instruments, which is not necessarily the case these days with a lot of music. It's not always people playing the music. As a fan of music, recorded music, I've always found it just intriguing, you know.
Well, let's get some sort of basic stuff about your composition method out of the way. So you have, this looks like something that was in a notebook, right? That maybe was not written sitting at a guitar, the lyric. Mm-hmm. Is that how you write? That you just...
It's a kind of combination. Like, yeah, you're right. Like with this song, the sort of the premise of the song, the idea of, you know, the line, what man regards as evil, God could care less about, that was certainly sitting in a notebook. That was something that I probably came across or thought about, and I'm always doing that, just jotting things down, thinking, okay, that'd be a good start for something, you know? And then the rest of it sort of flows depending on the songs. I might write without music half a song, if that, but generally if I'm writing and I get an idea for a song, I'll pick up a guitar, and then the two elements begin to build on one another. So lyrics build on chords and melody and vice versa. With this one, I really like the kinetic energy of it, and I didn't want to get too precise with things, so kind of just let things flow a little bit. The chorus, where it all comes back down to the Witness Like a Mountain part of the song, that's sort of the anchoring for the song. So everything sort of flows around that chorus and around that idea that everything comes back to stability of mountains, seas, forests, you know, your natural environment. And everything else that swirls around us is basically a story. A story we tell ourselves, a story we construct. So that was sort of the genesis for that song. But as far as the writing of it goes, yeah, I generally have a line or two here or there, a theme, and then I begin to build from there with the guitar.
Well, that initial aphorism, right, wouldn't I throw a match into your fireworks warehouse to learn what man regards as evil, God could care less about. I mean, did you even have in mind, that seems like something written in isolation. Did you even have in mind, like, who is being addressed? That this is maybe, I sabotage our relationship willy-nilly, you know, so there was, you know, as it clearly is, again, eventually revealed that this is sort of within the context of a relationship.
Yeah, it's a love song, basically, when you do it. Often, I find these days when I'm writing, a song isn't necessarily about one thing. Mm-hmm. They're rarely linear. I find they kind of have to reflect back on each other, on one, like if there's two or three ideas in a song, they have to kind of come back to one another and connect somehow. So my sort of obsession in the last, I think since COVID pretty much, and it comes into a lot of songs, is the idea that, you know, everything is made up. You know, we basically created our society, we've written our story, we follow our story, and, you know, everything from relationships to institutions to money to, you know, everything. We've created it. You know, it's a story we tell ourselves, and a good one. It seems in the last many years to be kind of deteriorating and falling apart, and yet we still don't kind of recognize it as something. We've created this, so we can also destroy it, which is a good and a bad thing, but I don't think we recognize it. I don't think it's, in general terms, it's kind of recognized that people haven't sort of stepped back and go, well, you know, this is something that we've all agreed upon. This is a story we've all agreed upon, and now if we stop agreeing upon the story, it is going to fall apart. So I think that's sort of where it starts from. Those macro songs, you know, songs about sort of social engagement or what's happening out there right now, I do like to bring them back down to the personal and to the micro, because I do think there are parallels. So, you know, this song starts with that sort of big idea, and then it falls back into a relationship and how those same sort of stories that we tell ourselves from a societal level, we also tell ourselves from a personal level, like your relationship to your loved ones or your whoever is the most important person in your life or your family. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all things that you create, you know, you have created them, not just through words, but all through actions, of course, but there is an agreed upon artifice to it all. So that's sort of the way it built. It started with a sort of the larger picture, and then kind of slowly dribbled down into the personal and sort of examining our relationship.
That explains well the second aphorism there. Oh, wouldn't I drop a fly into your bowl of guacamole to learn that everything you know is just another story. So it's not everything. It's not a criticism of the you. It's not. It's everything. No. All of us knows we are creating this.
Exactly.
But then going into the chorus, originally I had read the, you know, kind of as you were putting it, well, there are natural things that are standby and that are real and constant and underlying.
Yes. Yeah.
But it also sounds, because it's, you know, it's a bunch of commands. It's not the mountain is witnessing us. It is you are my rock. You are my world. I am bothered by these existential issues that makes me self-sabotage. And, but yet you are, you know, you just absorb it like the sea. And thanks for doing that.
Well, you know, again, it's both. Because that's the story, right? That's the story you created. You know, this person is my rock. This person will absorb this. This person will do this for me. These are the stories we tell each other. So that's an element of that. But the flip side of that is, like right now, I'm in the Adirondacks, right? So, I sit on my porch and I stare out, and there's a mountain there, and there's a lake there, and there's a 300-year-old tree. You know, you realize that we are just a part of that, and this is real, you know? Like, and we are as real as that, but the things that swirl around us, that we create, that we fabricate, that the relationships fit, not that they're not real, but they are completely fabricated. Like we are in control of them, you know, like we have, especially relationships, right? Mm-hmm. How we deal with one another on a one-to-one level. We are in complete control of that. And again, you can go deeper and say you're
right. It's how much of your character is under your control. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But you know what I mean? There's sort of they have a certain amount of, agency in how you deal with one another and how you deal with one another person. So that chorus, yeah, can read me both ways. It's like, yes, you are this. As far as my construction, you are my mountain, you are my sea, you are my forest. Or it's like, look, forget about the stories. Look at the world as a mountain, as a sea, as a forest. You know, they are stable, they are true, they are unchanging in many, you know, in our time scale. I never have answers in my songs. I also have lots of questions.
Sure. And if I'm pushing you to be too literal on this, like, I don't want to spoil anything. So feel free to to not answer or whatever. No. Verse 2 for a love song is pretty bleak, right? That, I mean, okay, I'll move back toward you one beat at a time, but this sort of sounds like a, I mean, I guess that's the dynamics of any long-term relationship, that you're going to sort of, you're not going to be necessarily close all the time, that things are going to move in and out, especially, you know, just with the things that we make ourselves crazy with. But yes, I could still make you sad. And I guess that's a good thing. Wow. All right. I mean, that's like, I just want to feel something.
Exactly. Well, again, it's the next line, right? Like somebody said, I guess that's a good thing, but my life comes apart whenever you're missing. So there is it's how if I couldn't make you sad, or if I, it means I couldn't make, and if I couldn't make you happy, and if I couldn't make you anything, then there's no relationship there, right? I'm nothing to you. So it's sort of looking at it like that. It's sort of like, you know, again, it's, we're back to the relationship and how it's constructed, but automatically go to, oh, I've made somebody sad, I made somebody cry. and that's a bad thing. It's how terrible. And it is. At the same time, the other side of that, it's a good thing because they care about me. The thing that I have done has hurt them. So it's sort of looking upon the story like that, you know, like
sure.
The story we tell ourselves is that I make you sad, that's bad. Well, it's not necessarily all bad because that means you care about me.
Sure. I mean, it works better as a after the fact, look on the bright side of a situation rather than a, you know, you got to test the pressure points every once in a while. You don't want to take each other for granted.
There you go. My wife and I have been married for 36 years. So, you know, we both tested a lot of pressure points and gone through a lot of stuff and a lot of life and a love. I mean, obviously, a relationship is extremely, extremely important to me from personal experience. It's not one happy day after the other, right? I mean, there's a lot of work involved.
Well, and you tour a lot, right?
Yeah, we're gone, you know, so much. We have three kids, you know, and those kids were growing up, you know, were right when we were touring our hardest and longest. And so, you know, there's lots of stress points in our relationship, which we've had to work through. And that's why I think a lot of my songs, I don't know if I have any straightforward, happy love songs, you know?
Well, I mean, you get close at the end. So even if she is being compared to absorbing like the sea and being steadfast like the forest, being a luminous, I'll let you know that you're a luminous beam scorching the heavens, screaming out to me, you know, much more dynamic, still a force of nature. But, you know, this is definitely not taking it for, you can take the forest for granted. Well, I mean, I guess with the logging, you can't, but you know, at least the rocks, you can take the mountain for granted.
Yeah, you can't take anything for granted anymore. The final lines, really, the two stanzas go together. You know, wouldn't I throw a rock through your childhood window to get your attention beneath the files and the pillow? So the idea there is, again, going back to the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we're built upon. You know, a lot of that is childhood, you know, if you want to use the cliche of the day, childhood trauma, your childhood day, you know, how you are dealt with by your parents and, you know, and you bring that up through your adulthood. So this is sort of going back to that, sort of saying, you know, if I could, I would rescue you from whatever was bad in your childhood and let you know that somewhere many decades down the line, years down the line, I will be there for you and we will be there together. And so it's sort of like a time machine going back into her past or the character's past and saying, look, if I could, I would let you know that things will be okay, basically.
All right. So what in your mind connects this complex sentiment about a relationship that has all this nature imagery and things with a little groovy beat down, like what how do those things fit together in your mind?
I think just the kinetic, the energy of it, you know, like I think the like lyrically, especially off the top, the, you know, throw a match to the Paris warehouse, the whole idea of the fly in the bowl of guacamole. It's just, I'm not necessarily using the words you would expect. And so there's a bit of energy in that, a little bit of like, huh? And then the beat sort of add the energy of it, of the music adds to that. Like, well, what is this song about? You know, this doesn't sound like a song about relationships, you know? The whole thing is supposed to be a little bit questioning. You know, the whole idea is that the duality of the lyric, the duality of the chorus, and the music, it kind of makes everything a little bit kind of on end. You're not really sure of your footing when you listen to the song until you sort of analyze it and sort of get into it. It's kind of, you can easily take it as a, you know, a little pop song the way it moves along, you know, but until you sort of listen to it and listen to the lyrics and then you go, oh, that's not about that. Maybe it's about this. So it's supposed to sort of throw you off a bit.
Sure. And I like, you know, presenting something that if you were sort of making it a tone poem, you know, you're doing Wagner, you're doing, you know, stayed like the mountain, you know, something that just ignore that, just get into the groove. And like, that's, you know, how do we deal with real complexity in our lives? Well, just groove it.
Get into the groove. There you go. Exactly.
All right. So once you have this, are you singing it at Margot? How much of the actual melody? Obviously, you know her vocal range.
Yeah.
So are you thinking in when you write when you write melodies in a?
Yeah. I usually write for myself, and then I have to change the key from Margot, which is always the drag. I'm writing the melodies, especially a song like this. She's got to understand not just the melody, but the rhythm of it, how it goes with the music, or with the guitar. You know, that's a big part of it, just rhythmically. That can be the tricky thing, you know, transferring it over. It's sort of like, I'm definitely hearing, especially a song like this, where it's very rhythmic orientated as far as the delivery of the lyric is concerned. That's got to be right. The words are written with a rhythmical pattern in mind. So it's very important that she gets that. And that's hard, you know. Melody is one thing. You can hear melody, but rhythm can be kind of tricky for some people. And so that's sort of what we work on. And that's what we got caught. And that's why I like the demo so much, because she caught the rhythm perfectly throughout it. Exactly what the way I was hearing it and the way I felt it, it translated best. So that's sort of why we kept the demo version.
So even the delivery of a line, like, I can still make you sad, I guess that's a good thing. Like putting that pause in there. Again, is that the kind of thing? Often a singer, yeah, you know, they're playing a cover, they're doing whatever, you know, they have some flexibility in where the pauses go and whether I'm going to hold the note, am I going to...
Yeah. Oh, no, she definitely has that flexibility. There are certain things where, I mean, again, that pause, I don't know if I put it in there or not, or she did. If she put it in there and I heard it, and it's like, okay, that's great, that's perfect, you know. I'm not one who thinks that a song can only be sung one way and one way only, but I certainly have an expectation of, again, in this particular song, of the rhythm of it just bopping along properly. So if she can change that rhythm, you know, if she changes that rhythm intentionally or non-intentionally, but it works, that's fine. But just as long as it doesn't stumble, you know, that pause and many things like that, she could have busy done herself. She has that flexibility to do it. And she often does. Once she gets familiar with the song, I think she always makes them better, you know, with those types of pauses, especially her phrasing. Melody, I kind of keep it pretty close to what it was, but again, occasionally she'll change the melody and go, okay, well, actually that's better, you know.
We've spent enough time in the song, I don't want to go into all the little arrangement details, but just, you mentioned Alan's original bass line, even though there's definitely a low bass that's doing something very simple, but this little funky thing, that's him playing this on high. I thought it was maybe baritone guitar, or even just the bottom of a regular guitar played like a bass.
Might be a baritone. It might be like a six-string bass. I can't remember what we use on that. Yeah, it does sound really high. So probably it might be the six. We do have a six-string on the studio, so we might use that for the high part of it. I can't remember. It's a long time ago.
Obviously, you're not trying to recreate these things when you play them live, right? You're just, you have your part that's going to be the same, and Margo's part is going to be the same, but everything else kind of whatever. I don't know. It's such a definite... That thing that he added, that sounds like it's one of the melodies of the song, but yet I'm hearing these versions, you know, we'll talk about in a second, the versions of He Will Call You Baby and then Rockin' Bird, where like Rockin' Bird, when you updated it for the acoustic version, it just, I think, gets rid of this moving bass part completely, such that, oh, I guess that wasn't what the song was about after all. It
We've always sort of had this view where the recorded song and the song we take live are very different beasts, and the recorded song is really just the song at that moment in time, right? That's where it is, and we don't feel like, okay, that's it, it's now an amber and it doesn't go anywhere. Like it's a growing and moving thing, and the reason some songs stay in our catalog for a long time, you know, obviously sometimes just because they're popular, but also because they continue to grow and move, and they're interesting for us to play. And there are some songs that, you know, we just don't play live because it's something we captured in the studio, and it's like, this one just won't translate well. And then, you know, for Throw a Match is one of those songs we have played it live, but when we play it live, it's just me and Margo and Jeff on mandolin. So we just play it as an acoustic song. We've never even tried it live with the bass and the drums. I don't know. I just don't think we would capture it properly. You know, it'd be a struggle. It'd be like one of those songs that you kind of never really get, you know. So I just feel like the best version of that song, of this version of the song, is on record. So, but I like the songs we moved it forward as an acoustic song, and it's very similar. It's got the same, it bops along. We sort of approach it upbeat, and Margo sings it very similarly. So that's a very key element in the recorded version of it.
So the big echoey, sloshy distortion guitar solo, is that Jeff playing mandolin with the effects on it? Okay. Yeah, that was a big surprise in the live thing, that like, what you would have thought is a lead guitar, that's just mandolin through a bunch of pedals. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, on the recording, that's guitar. That's me playing it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But on live, he just plays acoustic. None of the effects are there. It's just an acoustic song. Yeah. Most of the electric stuff on any record is me. And then because, you know, we have Jeff on the road with us, if I'm doing a rhythm part, then Jeff will do the electric part on his electric mandolin with pedals or whatever. And again, we just might change the arrangement just to make it work with the five pieces, as opposed to, you know, sort of unlimited numbers of pieces when you're recording.
Yeah, since I guess we're not otherwise going to talk about this, how much of your energy is spent with guitar pedals, because you know, I noticed your playing is not super technical.
No,
right? You're not playing super fast usually, right? If you have a, it's usually Jeff or some, you know, somebody else.
Yeah.
You've had a lead guitar in the, right? That's sort of been the floating position, right? Got the four of you, and then well, maybe we'll have somebody else that will take up some space.
Yeah, we usually have Jeff's been with us live forever since Trinity Session. He's always been on the road with us. We've had many other players as well. So sometimes the band will be six piece. I don't know if it'll be, it's been as many as during our Miles From Our Home tour, we had like 9 or 10 pieces. And the Caution Horses tour as well had 8 people. So, you know, it depends on the tour. And we don't do that as much anymore. Now it's much tighter and band, and the 5 pieces sort of seems to have stabilized. But again, we just, you know, just arrange songs around what we have, what we're taking out on the road with us.
Yeah. So I guess that's where seeing the live thing, where the most Velvet Underground-y kind of thing, that some of the songs can be quite a long jam, especially if you have a fun pedal that you are doing.
Yes, exactly.
That you can noodle around on, which occasionally comes out in the studio work. And I've heard some of your solo stuff that's, you know, a long thing of you doing something with pedals.
Yeah. I mean, the pedals are endlessly enjoyable because when you kick them in, you don't know what you're going to get, especially in a live situation. My pedals are very dial driven. I don't have anything locked in. So night to night, it can backfire on me, or there can be pleasant surprises. So I use those as sort of almost as inspiration to my playing sometimes. It's like, okay, well, this is the sound I'm getting. So let me follow that sound and see where it goes. So yeah, it's a big part of the lead playing for me for sure.
All right, let us get the second song out here. He Will Call You Baby. And again, we're going to hear the more acoustic junk version from just a couple years ago. It was originally on One Soul Now 2004. But I actually like this version quite a bit better. There's more going on. I guess that's Jeff's melodica. Is he playing throughout this?
No, that's an accordion.
Accordion. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Do you want to say a little about sort of where you're at in writing this one? Very sinister, slow. I really like it.
I love this song too. Like this is still in our repertoire. This has never left it. It's from our live repertoire. So the actual song itself, written during the One Soul Now writing sessions, that era, that's like around 2004 or so, 2003. Again, going back to relationships, we were right in the middle of my wife and I, 2 very young kids, a third about to arrive, a lot of touring. So, you know, a very volatile time in one's relationship, you know, not just one-to-one, but, you know, you have the household and life itself. You know, here I am, I'm in a band. We've just left the major label system, and we're starting to go back out on our own as independent. And I've got, you know, 2, almost 3 kids coming. You know, it's a very, very fraught time. So that a lot of the songs on One Soul Now are sort of written with that context. And so He Will Call You Baby is sort of about that. It's really about one-to-one relationships and how, you know, it's not really what you say. It's more of what you do, basically. You know, it's just because you call someone baby doesn't mean that you or darling or sweetheart. Doesn't mean that they are that to you. You have to actually show it as well. And sometimes you don't show it, but they still are your darling or your sweetheart. It's what I would later come to recognize as stories we tell ourselves, as stories we write. But back then it was a very difficult time to navigate and trying to figure out, you know, who we are to each other. And again, you have all these other factors coming into play to interfering with that relationship.
All right. So here's that 2025 version.
Wow. Sweetheart, but
will break all your fences down. She will call you a honey, leave you twisting in the wind. She'll call you darling, keep you stunned and wondering. She'll take you to another world, where the winds of confusion swirl. She will call you honey. Call them lucky as they watch their babies dance. Or maybe call them crazy for ever thinking they have a chance. They will carry her as far as they can, then abandon her once again. They will call her baby. They will call her baby. They will call her baby. They will call her.
So another very funky little part with you and Alan really locked together here. Yeah.
So the lineup on that version is actually Jeff Bird on bass. Yeah, he's on acoustic bass, stand-up bass. And then Yarrow Chervonets on accordion. Yarrow's the accordion player who played with us in on Trinity and on Caution Horses. And then me on acoustic guitar and Margo singing, of course. So that's the lineup for that one.
I thought there was eventually some hand percussion. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think so. It's probably just me hitting my guitar.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I swear. Okay. That I put for the first verse. Well, I put enter light hand percussion really mixes with the bass and percussive acoustic. So maybe it's just an auditory illusion there.
Yeah. It might be.
Anyway. Yeah. So a very nice kind of minor bluesy thing. It's still pretty concise, right? We're coming in at, well, less than 5 minutes, which given how 4:38, given how slow it is, and then you repeat at the end. Is this one that in live settings might expand itself out a bit?
Not really. We keep it pretty much the same. The ending we can extend sometimes. It can get pretty gnarly and mixed up, very Velvet Underground-y at the end, sort of get a bit atonal and try and push that side of it a bit, because you've had the standard sort of blues structure, and then it kind of devolves or disintegrates into this kind of sitting on the E minor and goes into nowhere. So it's kind of, we push it a bit, but not a ton.
Let me put in a clip from about 43 seconds in just to hear the transition, the last line when you're getting back to the verse. I think of the original version, the like is, you know, a bigger deal. It sounds more Zeppelin-ish or something, like a slow Zeppelin blues kind of thing.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll put in a clip right here of you, your guitar part from the original version, just to see. Yeah, so you're really, you know, it was a very electric part. It's a very, you know, reinterpreted for this to add in that funky strumming thing. So this was sort of the fundamental, what the song was your guitar part in some ways.
Yeah.
And now you're just throwing, so is that just a matter, was there a particular time where like, okay, we're getting acoustic versions of these together where you sort of start from scratch, or just, you know, we're trying to get a different take on the song, or?
This recording is live off the floor. That's all four of us playing at once. There's no overdub. That's sort of just us playing. So around this period, around when it was, this, and this was recorded, I know the Marcus came out in 2025, but this is the recording comes from around the time of One Soul Now as well. And around that time, Yarrow was back in the band for a short while, Yarrow, the recording player. And we were opening our show with an acoustic set, me, Yarrow, Jeff, and Margo, and me on acoustic. And it was very, it was like right now we have sort of a 3-song acoustic set in the middle of the show. Mm-hmm. This was opening the show, about a 40-minute acoustic set. So we took a lot of the songs that were in our repertoire and just reworked them for that set. And I think that then inspired the original acoustic junk record. We, the four of us, me, Margo, Jeff, and Yarrow, went to the studio after that tour and just recorded a whole bunch of the stuff that we've been playing live. And we sort of had the feel for it and sort of sat down over the course of a day and just recorded stuff. So that's from those sessions. So at this point, you know, we're very familiar with the songs. We're very familiar with each other and how we approach it. And you can really feel that in this song, I think, in this recording. There's a real, the lock is so great between all four of us. I think it's really cool. And, you know, it was just a different way of approaching the song from the way we recorded it. And even now when we play it live, it's very electric. And even those big shots, those big guitar shots, are even bigger now than we're back on the recording. We sort of push it in a whole other direction at this point, as far as the live version goes. But this was just something at that period. And again, we captured a great recording of it.
You know, given that Pete is your brother, a core member of the band, how does he feel about this whole, like, can't I just play bongos kind of, or is he happy to have the break?
I think, you know, as far as like when we were doing the whole set of acoustic, yeah, you know, him and Alan too, Alan wouldn't play as well. So yeah, they prefer to be playing, you know, I mean,
okay,
you know, and that's why we don't do it. I think I had suggested that a couple of years ago. I said, why don't we do that again? And I think I was like, I don't want to, I cut half of the songs I do over, you know, in the course of the night. And the only reason you're touring is to play the show, right? The rest of the day can be pretty straining and exhausting. So I sort of understood that. So, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, and we do the 3 acoustic songs in the middle of the set. I think because it's, again, we're trying to show a large dynamic of what we do live. And
sure,
I think everybody recognizes that. And it's a nice breather, you know, for everybody. And a way to play some songs that we aren't necessarily playing as a band, that over time have felt better just as a going right back to the basic guitar and vocals. So these are the things that you talk about and figure out over the course of many years of touring.
So say the you know, very prominent and melodic Yarrow accordion parts here, is that just, okay, here's the song and we've worked it up as a band and you do what you do and I'll complain if I don't like something that you're doing, but otherwise it is, in terms of who's going to play what where, how dense it's going to be, how much of a dictator are you being about the arrangement?
I mean, yeah, I guess you'd have to ask one of my subjects. I'll be the dictator I ask. I think I'm a benevolent dictator. So I have an idea in my head when we're working up arrangements, especially live. I am very open to the person who's playing certain parts to say, you know, how about this? Or to come up with their own idea. And to me, it makes it more interesting, you know, especially somebody like Jeff, for example, or Yarrow, who are fantastic musicians, so way, way better musician than I am, and have a real understanding of their instruments, and I think have good musical sense. So I give them a lot of leeway to sort of do what they want to do. There occasionally comes a time where it's like, look, you know, that, you know, I understand you know what you're doing there, but that's not working. Like, I don't think that's working. So let's dial that back a bit, or don't play there, or whatever, you know, there is a bit of that.
Yeah. In a live situation, you have to actually say that. In a studio, you can just pull them out.
Exactly. I delete. Exactly. Yeah. In the studio, definitely. I mean, you can do 10 takes of a song and ask them to do something different every time and then just pick and choose. Yeah, I'm talking live for sure. Mm. Live, it's more about letting them get their yayas out and just making sure it works with the context of the band and occasionally sort of tempering something down. But even in the studio situation, I'll hear an instrument, so I'll invite the person who plays that instrument in and sort of give them the song, say, let me hear what you hear first before I try and push it in any direction. I sort of want to hear what they hear first. It's more interesting that way to me.
Looking back to the song itself, the lyrics, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really interesting context that you provided, because I had, of course, heard this as a sort of warning about some sleazebag who's going to take advantage of you. But no, the sleazebag is, it's not, it's you. It's you and your wife.
Yes,
but yet you exactly. get to put these words in the mouth of someone who is not you. You're not singing it literally about yourself. Does the fact that you're not singing these give you some sort of removal objectivity, you know, that you could talk about yourself in the third person in this way, in a way that maybe if you were singing yourself, you would not do?
Yeah, absolutely. What can I say? It's very nice to be able to write a song, a very personal song, and hand it off. And it doesn't, it's not so personal anymore, you know, it becomes more universal. And it's not about me, you know, it's not me burying my soul or spilling my guts. It's somebody else interpreting somebody's spilt guts. It makes it easier for me for sure.
But yet, even in Margot's voice, it has to, you know, the fact that she's sort of whispery and, you know, I was reading on your wiki page about how it was sort of a big adjustment in the band that you were, you know, in these post-punk sort of things and like, oh, mm-hmm. no, now, you know, Margot doesn't sing that. She's not going to sing a piercing. It's not heart.
Yeah.
So you actually have to be under that. And that provides, you know, a really nice challenge to be subtle and mellow. And not a lot of harmonies, right? I was surprised in live that there were, I think, zero harmonies, right? Did anybody else have a mic? Did Jeff have a mic?
He has a mic, but not for harmonies. There's this one song that he sort of does a background line to. But harmonies. Certainly, again, we have had harmonies. I mentioned that Miles from Our Home Tour, we had two people singing harmonies. And through Open, I think through One Soul Now as well, we had somebody playing singing harmonies. But, you know, it's just a choice. And also even our albums, really, the last two albums, I don't think we've added any harmonies to any of the songs. With the record we're working on now, we are sort of contemplating harmonies. And Margot's began to sort of experiment with a few, like she has in the past. It goes in cycles, you know. It goes, you know, what the song requires. But live is just, harmonies are hard.
Yeah, sure, live, you know, sure. And she sounds so good against herself. Right. It's like Sting. Like, you want to hear Sting layer himself. You don't necessarily want to hear.
Exactly. And I do think that's a big part of it. Like, you know, Margot, as I say, it's not all about Margot's voice, but it's a big part of it is about Margot's voice. And especially live, like having Margot as the focus is really, really important. So I think that it's just her vocal up there is kind of important.
Well, just the fact that you don't face the audience, I was surprised that you are to her right, facing her.
Yeah, face the band. Yeah,
is I mean, I guess Alan is standing, so he can move around a little more. But it seems like you're sort. It's a semicircle, which I assume. I mean, that's always an adjustment, right? I assume when you guys practice, she is facing the rest of you. She doesn't have to just stand out in front and you know, hope that. Like, how does she get her cues from the drummer?
Yeah,
you know, you have to.
I give her the cues if there are any.
Sure. Okay, so you're always the one to count off and things.
Yeah. I'm sort of like the cue guy in the band live. If we get lost, you look to me. But generally speaking, you know, a lot of it is cued musically live. Even when we go off into certain spaces, there's certain melodies that somebody will play that I'll play or that will bring us back to a certain point and stuff like that. So there's all different ways of getting cues.
Let's get the third song out there. So Rock and Bird from The Caution Horses, 1990. There is a redone version for that 2025 More Acoustic Junk, but we're going to play the original version, and it's the album version, not the single version, right? With the pedal steel guitar on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say a little about where you were at this point, way back when.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I mean, as far as the lyrical goes, it's like a straightforward allegory type song. You know, there's three characters. It's a little bit of a moralistic tale, I guess. Kind of classic, if you want to put it this way. One woman, two guys, one represents one thing, one represents the other. The woman decides to go in this direction and the other guy heads off in another direction. To me, it's pretty straightforward. It's a bit too straightforward. Like when I listen to it now, when it's a bit, moralistic, I guess. The she in the song doesn't really have a voice. The person represented by the rock doesn't have a voice. It's really all about the bird. It's one of those songs that we sort of kept in the repertoire. Very occasionally we'll play it acoustically, but I'm not crazy about the song. From a pure songwriting point of view, I think the allegory works really well, but allegories can be pretty simple, you know.
Well, let's play it. So I picked this because, you know, I like the song. It's a catchy song.
No, that's good. Good. People do like it, though. So I'm not, it's all subjective, you know, very, very subjective.
Well, and some of it is, again, Alan's groovy bass part.
Yeah, great part.
Just really propels this forward. I mean, it's also really just nice melody and the rock and bird imagery, right? It's rock and roll and bird singing, like these very elemental things, but putting them in. There's no cliches in here, I feel
right.
Like,
okay,
right?
Good.
I mean, there's a bird singing something, but usually don't then quote the bird, quote the raven, whatever. Yeah. And it's just very concise. I have to ask, it's only because Spotify now has a play video option. that in the hour before we were talking here that I like, oh, let me just look at the video. Oh no, the video is a totally different recording of it.
Okay.
Or a different overdub. So is it, do you remember if this was lap steel or pedal steel or who was doing that or why?
It would have been, it's pedal, on Caution Hour says it's pedal steel. It's Kim DeShaw, who Kim played with us on Trinity and Caution Horses, Jeff Bird on mandolin, David Howden on percussion. There's quite a conga part done in that. Pete on drums and Al on bass, of course, and me on, I guess, the electric rhythm guitar. You mentioned, you really love the way the bass sounds and the way it propels it. And that's sometimes enough of a reason to include a song, too. Sometimes it's a song that I feel, from my point of view as a songwriter, I'm not crazy about, but Al will do a part or Pete will do a part or the song will come together musically. Where it's like, oh, this is just, this is such a great feel or a great vibe or a different vibe. And so we'll go with it, And I think that if I can't remember precisely, but this was probably one of those songs where I couldn't deny the strength of Al's part and the strength of everybody's part. So you can't hit a home run every time. But I do think musically it's a very cool song. It's a great, it's a very cool group, very different group for us and a very different group for that album too, which is important.
So then I have to ask you about the single used for the video, Bruce Hornsby. I guess it's the same recording, but you just stripped off the pedal steel and just let him do whatever he wanted. And he fills the entirety of the space such that then you even have in the video, I guess he was, what, why is Stephen Wright in the video?
Those are strange days. So the idea of Hornsby, probably, I'm sure, without a doubt, came from the record company. We did a short tour with him. Great guy. And he was also on RC at the time as we were. And I'm sure some bright spark came up with the idea of get Bruce to play on one of the songs and we'll use that as an alternate single. So sure, whatever. We're very open to these ideas, It's like, okay, sure. Bruce Hornsby is a great player. Let's have him. And, it's fine. So we went with that. And, it's just, as I say, we don't look at our recorded songs as these, we don't put them in amber, right? So they're supposed to grow. So sure, let's add somebody else to it. And then the video, Stephen Wright, now you mentioned him. It's like,
then he sort of looks a little like Bruce Hornsby.
But he became a bit of a friend. He would come to shows and hang out and do his Stephen Wright stuff without even knowing he was doing his Stephen Wright stuff. And so I think, I guess somebody just asked him, hey, we're got to do this video. Do you want to be in it? And he said, sure.
I mean, I guess that just says something about, the flush of fame of like, oh, these people.
Yeah.
I could do things with these people. Like, well, how could you not? Okay, maybe it's not,
absolutely
point artistically, but
yeah.
So what?
Even, videos for us at this point where we didn't give a shit about them, sure. if we don't have to be in it, then that's a good video. That was sort of our goal. So, then there would be, of course it was so important to the record company because of MTV at the time. But we had no interest in them. So we very rarely got involved in that side of it. And as I say, if it didn't involve us, then we were fine. And the Caution Horses, this is like the album after Trinity Session. We're riding very high as far as our fame is concerned. And, we were meeting a lot of different people, a lot of interesting people come to shows and we meet them and some we'd connect with and continue to be friends with and some would sort of pass through. But yeah, it was kind of a fun time. So, we enjoyed it. Janine Garofalo was in one of our videos and Ned Beatty was in a video.
Wow.
You had fun with all that stuff.
All right. I will admit that the allegory, I'm not entirely clear on the literal imagery here. Looking at someone has kept the rock and the bird as prisoners, putting your hood on your falcon. So usually a love song, an analogy, whether it's about an abusive relationship or whatever, involves two. Why are there three here?
Let me look at this year's song that somebody wrote many years ago. So there's the woman and there's the two guys. So there's a battle for the two guys. One is rock and one is bird. And she, of course, decides the battle. Trying to get her attention. So she captures them both who are interested in her. And, the imagery goes that one is rock, who's a very stable presence. The other is bird, who's a more flighty, but endless possibilities because of the sky, his ability to fly, basically. Mm-hmm. Captures them both, ties them together. So finally, she decides to untie them, throws them to the sky. Of course, the rock comes falling back right down to her feet, and the bird flies away. So her attempt to control, she limits her possibilities by basically letting the bird's gonna do what the bird's gonna do, and the rock's gonna do what the rock's gonna do. So that's sort of what it's about.
The bird gets the last word.
the bird's up there and sort of saying, look, you know, I offered you something here, you've rejected it, so see you later.
Well, I guess actually the instrumental gets the last word. So
there you go. There you go.
I don't know. Does the instrumental represent the rock or something? No.
Sure. No, the bird. Okay. The bird.
All right. I'm glad that you don't like this song that much, because maybe you would have been resistant to literally unpacking it in that way if you found it more precious.
No, I never find anything too precious.
I guess to wrap up here, we wanted to introduce a fourth song that we're not going to talk about afterward, because we'll be done here. And I picked Unanswered Letter from the Wilderness Nomad series, Volume 4. So just something from that period, which was 2012.
Yeah.
What was the deal with that whole, we're going to name it that, is because you wrote them on the road? Why do we even have this series?
We were at the end of all of our various contracts, you know, licenses, publishing, everything. We were completely free. We were in control of anything we wanted to do. And we were also sort of at a strange place in our career, sort of like, well, do we just do another record? You know, we had done three records with Rounder at that point, and it had been a good relationship, but it had done its course. And so it's sort of, well, do we just do another record? So we kind of kicking around. I was sort of writing another record, but feeling like this doesn't feel like it should just be a record. So we sort of kicked around the idea, well, should we try and push ourselves into a double album, or maybe we should do a live record or whatever. We were kicking around these ideas, and through fortune, we came up with this idea of doing four records, putting a time limit on it of 2 years to make us get it done. And then having each of the records sort of express a different side of the band. So we have the first of the Nomad series is Renmin Park, which was sort of based around a journey that my family and I took to China, and we lived there for 3 months. And so it's based all around that, and about sounds, very, very experimental record. And that sort of represents that side of our personality. The second record was called Demons, and it was all Dick Chestnut covers, and they represented we were a big cover band. It's a big part of what we do. The third record was Singing My Meadow, which was done very over one day in our studio with Jeff Bird. And it's very psychedelic, very noisy. It sort of represents that side of our live personality that you don't see much on studio. And then the fourth record, the series was called The Wilderness, which was basically a singer-songwriter, like more folky, kind of back down just to my songs and kind of more standard. And so Unanswered Letter comes off of that record.
All right. And there is a version of that on the More Acoustic Junk. That's more straightforward than this. But I think what attracted me to this version was just, you know, the initial wash of synths, and it's sort of a different, almost free verse thing that where Margo starts singing that. There's a blog post I will link folks to where you sort of explain a little bit of what that song is about. So I'll let people explore that on their own and link them to the other versions of these. So just for you mentioned doing these covers, which I enjoyed quite a few of your covers in listening through the things here. I mean, this maybe shows again that you're not so precious about your songwriting it is my genius and my poems, and I'm bristling with all these poems, and I can't, you know, we always have to fight. Even just having, well, I know at the show that Jeff Bird has his own solo albums, and you sort of were like promoting those, but we're not gonna, you know, the fact that you're in the band doesn't mean we play your songs. This is what we do,
right?
But yeah, we do covers. But yeah, I didn't even ask you, you know, the first one we started with, Misguided Angel, right? That's Margo has a co-write on that.
Yeah,
does that mean she wrote some lyrics or all the lyrics?
No, about half of them, maybe three quarters, certainly the chorus. So she sort of brought this idea to me, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Yeah, I like so I basically completed it and then structured it musically.
So what is the dynamic in terms of, you know, there's not the usual, especially with siblings, you'd kind of expect like, oh, now Pete has a bunch of songs or, you know, just people haven't, is there not that pressure, or you've just established this is what the band is. It's been around a long time. We're not going to add extra songwriters or.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Al does a lot of writing as far as music goes. So he'll certainly the last few years, yeah, he'll send me musical ideas, which I'll then take. And if I use it, I'll work with lyrical ideas or melodies to it. And sometimes restructure them or whatever they go in whatever direction they go in. So he does that. Margaret doesn't have any interest in songwriting anymore. She never really did. I sort of, in the early days, I kind of pressured her a bit to do it, so I didn't have to do it all myself. You know, so she had a few kind of cool ideas. And Pete doesn't. I've never heard him express interest at all in writing a song. He just wants to play drums. So,
Yeah, drummers are always a different animal. Like, are they? They're athletes.
Exactly. They're goalies.
Well, thanks so much for walking through all this. I really, really had a good time exploring the catalog.
Thank you very much.
All right, here's Unanswered Letter from the Wilderness Nomad Series, Volume 4. Thanks.
Turning to a home.
Thanks so much to Michael. As I indicated, it maybe took me a little while to really get this band. Most of it is quite pleasant and mellow and often quite dark, so there's an emotional peel. But I think it's worth your time to pick an album and just give it enough repeated listens until it really sinks in. And I know their earlier albums are what they're most famous for. I think they've gotten better and better. Again, learn more about them at cowboyjunkies.com. If you go to the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, you'll see I've linked to some of their appearances on big-time talk shows in their famous days in the 90s. And you can hear Michael's solo and side projects there, his earlier bands Germinal and Hunger Project. Now, if you want to support this podcast, get your episodes ad-free, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, which will also get you the notes to this episode, right? The lyrics, the song structures, thoughts I had about which parts were more important than other parts, many of which I probably didn't actually bring up during the discussion. Now, I have recorded two episodes since this one. The first with Bruce Sword, the singer and guitarist for The Pineapple Thief. That is a British contemporary progressive rock band, but very chic, very listenable, really good melodies. He's just released a solo album. And then this week, I talked to Josh Joplin, which if you were listening to the radio in 2001, you definitely know his song Camera One, even if you don't know that title. Just look him up. Very good singer-songwriter. And I've got a jam-packed schedule for the entire rest of the summer. I hope you're subscribed directly to this podcast. I would love for you to go to the Nakedly Examined Music Apple Podcasts page and leave a nice 5-star rating if you feel that it is warranted. And I welcome your guest suggestions, your feedback. Maybe you want to be a guest. Reach out to me, mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Hope your summer's going well. Hope you're being creative. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off. Misguided angel, love you till I'm